on this special edition of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We're talking fake Twitter accounts, fiber is good for your diet, and virtualization. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for the following show is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, Virtualization Special, recorded August 24th, 2012. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second one free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And buy social media solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with social media solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. This is the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is put together. I'm Father Robert Ballister, your host, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And we've got a fantastic panel here for this special, starting on my left with Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, tell us, you've got a new title there. What does it mean?
Actually, I just bragging a little bit about new hat. I am now the evangelist for Thin Links Corporation. We make thin clients for Remote FX and Citrix HDX. So I thought it was appropriate for today's episode.
Absolutely. And our today's episode is actually defined by our in-studio guest, Mr. Lou Maresca. You know and love him from the chat room as Lou MM. Lou, thank you for coming in and actually sitting with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, do you want to explain a little bit to the folks at home who you work for and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a software developer at Microsoft. I've been there for about 9 years and worked on multiple different products, from Office Range products, ERP, which is Enterprise Resource Planning, and CRM.
And today we're going to be talking all about virtualization. Yeah. But before we get to that, we do have a little enterprise bite here. Brian, have you heard about this story about how easy it is to buy fake Twitter followers?
Well, it's horrible, isn't it?
It's a travesty. It's a tragedy. It's one of these stories that maybe we don't care so much about, but maybe we should because, well, social media is becoming more and more important in the enterprise. And if I can buy myself 30,000 followers for $20, then I really am not rewarded for actually putting in the grind work to build up a following. Lou, have you heard about this story?
Yeah, definitely.
So what's your take on this? Some people are saying, well, this is just the cost of doing business. I mean, you need to have a following in order to actually earn a following. So there's those people who have next to no posts, next to no follows, but they have 50,000 followers. And they say, okay, that's where the account starts. But what's your take?
I think sooner or later someone is going to try to monetize on this type of thing. I mean, it basically gets them over that initial hump of, you know, followers so that they can basically, you know, monetize on the actual amount of users that are watching them. So
right. You know, there's also people who say, well, look, Twitter's actually encouraging this because you can pay Twitter to be featured. You can pay Twitter to get prominent location so that more and more people follow you. So there are those who are saying, look, if Twitter's doing it, why can't I do it? I have 60,000 ghost accounts and I'll sell them for, you know, a couple of cents a pop. I'll make decent money and I'll get someone to have a start in their social media account. Now, Brian, aside from some of the fuzzy moral issues concerned here, do you think it makes sense for an enterprise to start this way, to build up a following that's fake in order to get a following that's real?
Oh, man, I totally think this is a slippery slope. As a journalist for InfoWorld, another hat, sorry, you get paid based upon how many people read your article, how many people are following, you know, RSS feeds and things like that. So it's kind of like when newspapers accidentally deliver an extra, you know, couple thousand newspapers just to get their distribution up. It's cheating, pure and simple. And what it's doing is it's taking away money from legitimate journalists. So I feel very strongly that this is really a bad thing to do.
Yeah, and there is a sense of, well, look, if I've been chugging at this for 3 years and I finally, I mean, I have under 3,000 followers. But when I finally get to that point, I feel a sense of accomplishment. And right now on eBay, I just typed in Twitter accounts. I can get 40,000 Twitter followers, buy it now for $25.99. So I mean, what does that say about actually building up a social network versus buying a advertising platform? Lou, I mean, Microsoft has a position in social. What would be the corporate response to something like that? Someone trying to game their popularity, say, on Xbox Live.
Yeah, so I mean, I can't obviously speak for Microsoft and how they would actually do this, but you know, for me, if you basically had somebody paying for, you know, followers, it would be almost in my best interest to figure out which accounts were fake in order to get around that, in order to get the real population, the real viewer.
Right, right. I believe last week on Twit, Leo showed a service that goes through your account, person by person, up to 5,000 accounts, and it actually looks for fake accounts. It looks for those accounts with the Easter eggs, you know, no picture, or accounts that have no post or just spam posts. And then it rates your account according to, well, what the percentage of fake accounts you have. Now, it only does the first 5,000, so if you have 100,000 or a million followers, it's not completely accurate, but it's a pretty good indicator of who's trying to game the system and who's truly building up a Twitter following.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Brian, I want to give you the last word on this. As a journalist, you're all about integrity. If someone's gaming the system, what do you think the response should be?
You know, that's actually a really tough call. InfoWorld actually doesn't let me see any of those numbers. Our integrity position is that we actually have a separation of church and state, so I'm not allowed to see those things. I'm just supposed to put out quality content and let the sales guys figure that out. From a personal standpoint, I just don't like it. You know, gaming the system just feels dirty and dishonest.
Right. And you really are breaking down that wall between the journalist, between the content creator and the marketer. When the journalist and the content creator and the marketer all become the same person, it leads to all sorts of compromised, well, let's just say compromise. We'll leave it at that. You know, when we meet in person, we take a lot of cues that we may not realize. The person's facial expressions, how they're holding their hands, the way that they tilt their head. These all give us information about what they're thinking, about how they're reacting to what we're saying. Now, you lose that in a regular telephone conference. You lose that if you don't have that face-to-face element. But how do you get it if you're not actually in the same place? How do you get that experience if you're not in the same office, the same building, the same city? That's why I use GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. The interface is really simple to use, and it allows us to, well, have high-definition video conferencing with just a few clicks of the button. GoToMeeting takes simple online meetings and, makes a big step forward with the highest quality HD video conferencing available. With one click, you can share your screen to work with others on the same document. You can build trust. You can stay focused. You can turn your business ideas into action. That's what GoToMeeting is all about. Plus, GoToMeeting is extremely simple. And anyone who's ever managed a team knows that you need to keep it simple to make your team use it. If it's a great experience, a great solution, a great service, but complicated, your team simply won't take the time to use it. GoToMeeting is as simple as sending an email or setting a calendar date, and that's what makes it, well, a win. Well, here's what we want you to do. Try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Be sure to use the promo code ENTERPRISE, and we thank GoToMeeting and Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Cheever, what do you know about fiber?
Oh, It helps keep you regular.
Well, it definitely does that. But in this episode of Stuff My IT Guy Says, we're going to show you the difference between the types of fiber and what they can do for your network. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, host of TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWiET Network. I'm here at the Interop Hot Stage Warehouse in Brisbane, California, where we're building one of the largest temporary networks in the world, and we're here for another edition of Stuff My IT Guy Says. I'm sitting next to Mr. Mark Sullivan. He's one of the engineering team leads for Interop. Mark, thank you very much for coming on.
You're very welcome, Robert.
And you're going to talk about a subject that is near and dear to your heart, and that is fiber.
Absolutely.
Now tell me, what do you got in front of you?
Okay, so what we have in front of us today is we have some single-mode fiber, mm-hmm. we have some multi-mode fiber, and we have some optimized multi-mode fiber.
What are the differences in the characteristics? When would I use single-mode? When would I use multi-mode? When would I use optimized multi-mode?
Certainly. And one of the things I want to make sure that I mention is there's a lot of this is driven by several components. One is cost, okay, and obviously, you want to have the right build for the right cost. The other one is for your throughput, okay, and then finally your distance. So if you want to go the greatest distance, which also carries the greatest cost, of course, you're going to go with the single mode fiber.
Okay. And if you need something that's just quick, down and dirty, will work short distances, I use multimode.
The multimode, correct.
And where does optimized multimode
fit in? Optimized multimode is kind of right in the center of the two. I mean, if you think about it, is kind of mid-length runs, and but it does do the 10 gig throughput.
Why do they have such wildly different characteristics?
Okay, so the characteristics is typically in the core size. Okay, so let's start with the multimode fiber. This is 62.5 microns. Okay. The optimized multimode is 50 microns, and the single mode is actually a very small 9 microns
in diameter. I get it. So the core is the actual part of the fiber. This is all just the sheathing and the cladding.
Absolutely.
That's the part that actually carries the light.
That's correct. And actually, there's a lot of protection around this. Most of what we have here is protection for the fiber. There may be a little bit of Kevlar in there, some cladding, but the actual fiber itself that's running right down the center is really what's doing all the work.
Now, I see that you brought a laser here, which means we can demonstrate to the people at home exactly what's going on here. So this is a standard laser, and I'm going to hook it up to the single mode fiber here, and when I turn it on, you can see that the pattern is actually pretty uniform.
Yes.
And I can bend the fiber, and it might change the outsides, but that the core of the light stays a nice, consistent, solid red.
That's correct. And that's part of what we're looking for in order to throw the signal for long distances.
Right. And whereas if I hook up my multimode fiber here and turn on the laser, it looks like a bit more chaos.
Yes.
And if I start to move around the fiber itself, the pattern actually changes.
That's correct.
Which tells me that in a single mode fiber, the light's going straight down the middle, whereas in a multi mode fiber, since it's such a big core, it's kind of bouncing around from side to side.
That's exactly correct. I mean, in a multi mode fiber, you have a lot more of the ups downs, whereas with the single mode fiber, everything's running primarily straight through the core, and that's why you can throw it a much greater distance.
Right. You said that there are ways to tell about the fiber that you're using just by reading the outside of the jacket.
It's very common, especially with multi-mode fiber, to have 50 and 62 and a half micron fiber be an orange color. And so every fiber has this printed on the outside. And we can see as we look at this says 62 and a half multi-mode fiber. The single-mode fiber will have the same thing as well. And so that's always important. The manufacturer's required to put that on there.
Let's get a bit more brass tacks. Mm-hmm. In a network like Interop, we're going to be using all three types of fiber.
Absolutely.
And the way that we do that is we use SFPs or SFP pluses, which allow us to switch out the type of laser and the type of fiber that we're going to be using within our switches.
Correct.
So tell me how I would design all three types of fiber into a network like Interop.
Okay, so in Interop, if you're making long runs between between halls or between locations, if you're going to have to run up to anything over 550 meters, you're going to have to use single mode fiber in order to do that. that. If you're, let's say you're within the conference space, but it's still a long run, because in the interop, we're using an area that's the size of multiple football fields. Let's say you have to go across all of that space. Well, you're probably going to want to use your 50 micron optimized multimode. And then finally, if you just have a cross connect within a rack or between two racks closely placed next to each other, you're going to go ahead and use your 62.5 micron.
Right. And again, it's build to spec. If
Absolutely.
You have a short distance and you need to push 10 gig, you can use multimode.
Yes, you can.
If you need a longer distance and you still need to push 10 gig, you use optimized multimode.
Right.
And if you have a long distance and you need to push 10 gig, you use single.
That's exactly correct.
And each step gets a bit more expensive.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, of course, the best place for them to find out how fiber is used is to go visit a networking show. You know, mm-hmm. find one near you and just start asking questions. Or if you want to see the premier networking show, you got to find Mark or find me at the NOC at Interop. We do it every year. We're in Las Vegas. We're in New York. Come talk to us and find out how Interop uses fiber to drive your bits. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire. This is Mark Sullivan. This was Stuff My IT Guy Says, and you've just been learned. Now, T-Bert, at Interop, we have two rules about fiber. Do you remember what they are?
Oh, yes. One of them is don't cut the fiber. And the last one is don't look into the fiber with your remaining good eye.
That's right. Because there are actually lasers traveling through a lot of these fibers, which means that if you do one of these quick checks to see if the end of the fiber is still clean, yeah, that might be the last thing you actually see. It'll carve a nice little pattern on your cornea. Now, this is the laser that we use. This is the demonstration that we use. It's just in case people wanted to see, if you could switch over to the single, you can actually see the pattern of the laser as it's changed by the walls of the fiber. This is one of the coolest demos that you can do in a class. Unfortunately, we don't have enough zoom here. You don't have enough resolution. Because this is a multimode fiber, the pattern of the light actually changes as I move the fiber. And again, that's because the core is so big that the light bounces around. And because it bounces from side to side, it's actually going to change what that pattern of light looks like. Now, Chibert, you've dealt a lot with fiber. You run fiber all the time. And you actually, I remember you had a story about terminating fiber in the roof of the convention center in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah. In those days, we actually had to terminate, put connectors onto the fiber itself, and it was snowing. Lots of fun. Snowing and windy. But actually, the worst place I've ever had to do fiber was actually on a little boat about a mile offshore, fixing some connectors in an undersea observatory and having this little boat bounce around and trying to avoid not puking on my fiber.
Yeah, I believe puking on your fiber would disqualify it as clean fiber. Yeah, I think we could all safely agree on that, yes. Now, we do use all three types of fiber in pretty much every network that we ever assemble, including the Interop network. So, Lou, you've got nine nanometer fiber. We've got the 50. This is the optimized multimode. And then we've got the 62.5 over here. Now, the important thing to remember about this and the important thing to remember about Stuff My IT Guy Says is that this gives us information about the world, about the technology, about the gear that keeps us connected. You know, when we built the Twit Studio, we wanted to do as much as possible in the cloud. Our documents are handled in the cloud. Our email is in the cloud. Our scheduling is done all in the cloud. Well, because we want to eat our own dog food. We want to practice what we preach. This internet revolution is real, and that's why when we started looking at a phone system, we looked at RingCentral. Our tech guy, Russell, said, look, there's a phone system that operates entirely in the cloud. That means no bulky PBX system in the basement. That means no difficult installation of additional cables. Basically, if you're wired for the internet, you're wired for your phone with RingCentral. It's a true cloud-based phone system. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their voicemail in their email. We get our fax messages right on our smartphones, and we get an easy-to-use interface that lets us customize how we get our communications. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. We thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Lou, what do we mean when we say virtualization? Because it seems like everyone has a different definition.
Yeah, so I mean, back in the 90s, it was really, really easy to basically expand your organization's network by just, you know, adding more servers. It doesn't matter where you're placing them because hardware was cheap. But imagine that property got expensive. And so nowadays, virtualization is basically about consolidating your servers, bringing them down to a much less expensive space, and by actually adding more functionality to just single servers. So you can have that one DIN unit, that one unit in a server room that basically does things like IIS and other different functionality. If you want to expand and add new functionality to that server, you just basically add additional memory, add additional processor, add additional storage.
So what you're really talking about is the virtualization phenomenon is getting things out of my data closet, out of my rack, out of my colo, and putting it somewhere else. You know, the popular term right now is cloud, but it really just means a server somewhere else, someone else's system, someone else's infrastructure. Now, Chibert, you've had a lot of work with virtualization. Now, what have you seen in your needs? Because I know you run your own colo and you run a colo for the university. What have you seen as we've moved more and more into operating systems that support virtualized processes?
Well, the whole deal is you're able to better use that hardware platform. Most of the power supplies in modern servers are very, very efficient, but they're not efficient at low utilization rates. So if you're just running a server, say a web server, you're probably poking along at maybe 2, 3, 5% utilization. Realistically, that power supply doesn't really start getting efficient until up into the 50, 60% range. Now, speaking of power, the University of Hawaii actually is funding the build-out of a virtualization cluster specifically because we want to get the departments to quit putting servers in a closet in the department office. Having the physical server in the department offices, say an office building or something like that, means we can't shut the air conditioning down at nights and weekends. Just moving the servers out of these offices into a real data center is going to save us upwards of $10 to $15 million a year in electricity, a mighty fine reason to virtualize.
Right, I remember the days where you could actually walk over to a rack, to say a 42U rack, and there were literally 42 pizza box servers. One U boxes. And you could name the services that were running on each and every single one of those boxes. Well, we don't do it that way anymore. We can't do it that way specifically because it's just too expensive. One of the reasons why virtualization has caught on so quickly is because there is that immediate ROI. Lou, what have you seen on your side? As vendors move to virtualization, do they understand the cost savings that they can occur?
I don't think right away. I think they basically have to pay for extra hardware. You know, they're basically buying new hardware. But what they don't realize is in the long term, things actually even out. And in fact, they might not only even out, but better for them because now they're getting rid of all these other servers that they don't necessarily need. So it's better for them.
Right. It's better for them, but there's actually something else I want to cover, and that is there's been a change over the last, say, decade where people really used to not trust. There was a paranoia, especially in the enterprise, about moving anything out of my data center, anything out of my data closet. I wanted my servers and my switches to be in one place. I wanted to know exactly where all my data was stored, and I could only do that if I had it under lock and key. Let's fast forward 10 years, and now people seem to be okay, even startups, with putting their entire infrastructure out in the cloud, into a virtualized environment. Why do you say, or why would you think that that's now possible?
So I think basically the younger generation is more acceptable to the internet today, and they know that things, companies and corporations, enterprise businesses are trying to make things more secure and easier for you as an entity to utilize remote type virtualization and remote type administration. So as they get more acceptable, so is virtualization type things.
Right. Chibert, have you seen that on your side? Have you seen people being more trusting of virtualization and understanding that it can actually provide greater uptime to their industry?
Well, one of the big issues is cost. You know, there's a human resource cost, there's a physical cost, you know, the equipment and so forth, maintaining it all. But one of the best illustrations I ever saw was when this one particular company, well, in this case, the New York Times, was doing a very, very large project. And they had scanned all the back issues of New York Times, but they then had to index them. Well, they were looking at either spending an additional $10 million to build a temporary data center just to index the back issues, and then afterwards having to sell all the used equipment and take apart the data center. Instead, what they did was they actually bought the use of 5,000 virtual machines over one weekend, got it done, and was small enough that the CFO paid for it on his credit card.
So that's one of the things that I absolutely love about the new virtualized environment, which is if I have a traditionally, if I had a big project and I needed a lot of computing power, I would actually have to go out and buy the systems. I'd have to cluster them together, normally have to buy a couple of system admins to make sure everything was working properly. And then maybe I only use it for a month, or maybe I only use it for a day, but I still own all that hardware. I still have to keep it cool. I still have to keep it stored and keep it safe. With the new virtualized environment, I can buy CPUs. I can say, look, I need 10,000 CPUs from this time to this time. Just pay for that, run my process, and be done with it. Now, Lou, do you see corporations becoming more and more accepting of that model of computing?
I think so, because basically it allows them to have full control over their systems, but not necessarily have to put the cost behind it. So, I mean, it really does help them kind of control the environment in the area.
All right. So, one of the things that we really need to discuss right now is, well, what happens once you start virtualizing your services? And let's be clear here. We're not necessarily talking about putting things in the cloud, although the cloud is a clear usage of virtualization. There are industries out there that have private cloud, that have private virtualization, that you have your servers in a colo and they're only for you, and just your services are virtualized on that storage server. However, and maybe Chibert, you could speak to this as well, what do we do about regulatory compliance? Let me give you worst case scenario. Let's say I run a small to medium business that deals with medical information and that has to be SOX, Sarbanes-Oxley compliant. So now I have to have all my financial records in order, and I have to keep all my patient order data confidential. How do I do that if I'm, say, sharing resources with other parts of the company, or worst case scenario, other companies? Open question.
Well, hey, I top your example, and my example is actually from the U.S. military. They actually run clouds. There's one on the Nippernet, one's called on the CipherNet. Basically, they are complete clouds. The CipherNet is actually a fully classified system that's physically separated off from the rest of the world. Now, getting back to your example, a small corporation that's publicly owned, publicly traded, so it has to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley, and it's dealing with medical information, so it has to deal with HIPAA. A lot of cloud providers and virtualization providers have such things built into their service level agreement. So one of my favorite tricks for something like that is I will actually only expose a VPN interface so that you can't get to it unless you go through multiple layers of encryption. In the department, in the military and federal, we have a saying called defense in depth. Don't trust a single technology. The cloud vendors have taken this to heart, and they're helping the corporations that use them to layer in the defenses so that if there's a failure in one piece of technology, it doesn't leave all your intellectual property, all your private information exposed to the world.
Right. And, that's always good practice. It's always a good practice to have multiple layers of security so that you can give appropriate access or zone access to the people who should have it. But, again, planning and executing that is always difficult. Lou, I want to toss it back over to you because, well, let's let the elephant into the room here. Hypervisor. Let's talk about how we can use Microsoft's technology to deal with some of these compliance issues or to deal with some of these security issues.
Sure. There's a great story that I heard recently about a medical company, you know, basically having somebody run in and steal a bunch of hard drives and all the patient information on those hard drives. And there's a lot of companies, even, you know, VMware being one of them, Microsoft being one of them, trying to to maintain that stability and that security of data. And one of the things, like, for instance, in Hyper-V 2012, they brought basically BitLocker to the enterprise level. So you have what they call BitLocker encrypted cluster volumes. So it basically allows you to create large cluster nodes, 64 nodes, 44,000 machines, doesn't matter what. And as long as that BitLocker pin is there, they basically have two options, BitLocker pin or format the hard drive. So there's really nothing else. So those types of things, those types of security helps with compliancy.
Now, how would you layer that? So as in Brian's scenario, he has multiple layers of security so that even if you happen to get past the VPN, you can't get into the encrypted data store. Or even if you get into the encrypted data store, perhaps you don't have access to the store you want to get into because it's on a separate VLAN. How do I use BitLocker in Congress with other security measures in order to lock down who can access what on my virtual infrastructure?
Sure. I mean, basically, you can break up, like, for instance, Hyper-V 2012, you can break it up, clusters into specific nodes, and then encrypt those data streams to those nodes. And so basically, you're kind of blocking out any type of intruder in that type of situation. So there's more and more situations where it prevents the attacker from getting that data.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to go to a different topic, but it's very closely related, and that is, well, we're in this post-PC era, or at least everyone keeps saying we're in a post-PC era, where we see more and more data being accessed on tablets and on phones. And there's actually a big opportunity for the enterprise here to take the lead in providing a virtual infrastructure for those tablets. Brian, I want to throw this to you, because I know that you're dealing with this with your new hat. What can we do with huge racks of virtualized servers and let's say an iPad or let's say a thin client?
Actually, I just ran across campus from a presentation for the University of Hawaii Manoa Chancellor. And I'm putting together a large project with the UH School of Architecture for teams of architects and students to go around and basically create as-built 3D drawings of the entire university. Now, the cool thing is they want to be able to do this with tablets. And what I'm doing is I'm actually doing a parallel project with both Citrix HDX and Remote FX. And the plan is to be able to run AutoCAD. Now, the weird thing about this is that Autodesk, up until the 2012 version, wasn't even legal to virtualize. So for those of people on the audience, keep in mind, just because you have software doesn't mean it can be virtualized. Check your end user license agreement. But being able to leverage a graphics processor inside the server is a very, very big thing. It's probably one of the biggest things to happen really since virtualization started. Being able to run all the heavy load at the server and only pop up an application window that's saying running AutoCAD or MatCAD or some sort of 3D application or, you know, even a game. The whole big trick is that the virtualization has changed to the point where the end user experience isn't really any different from a thick client. And every time a tech support person has to go out and visit a thick client, Gartner actually says that that's about $60 just to show up. So when you start multiplying that around, the HR cost savings is massive. And I must give Microsoft a really big shout out. Their System Center 2012 is absolutely stunning. Being able to update machines without them even being physically on, update, patch, even schedule the patching so you don't get this giant patch storm and overwhelm your system. Microsoft has done an amazing job of really thinking out how to make sure that the end user experience and the system's administration experience is much, much better and more automated.
Do you have any follow-up to that, Lou?
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft, like you said, has done a lot of things with Server Center, as well as just even the hypervisor itself, the free hypervisor. I mean, we have, like you said, live migration. You have, SMB live migration. You have data storage live migration, shared nothing live migration, creating clusters on the fly, expanding your system on the fly. So they've done everything they possibly can to kind of bring even the lower budget divisions into the virtualization space.
Now, I do want to bring it back because I don't want people to think that we're pitching all Microsoft here. I mean, obviously, you're from Microsoft, so that's your bent. Mm-hmm. And Brian, you've used a lot of Microsoft software, as have I. But, there are some big players here, including VMware and Citrix, who
are all pushing for the same vision, and that is to have a truly virtualized data center where you don't have to own anything to run your services. Now, as we move closer and closer to that, this is an open question to you. Where do you see this leaving the small to medium business who really has no use to own their own equipment?
So, I mean, basically, if they don't have the budget to own their own equipment and they don't have the space, if they don't have the administration people, basically, this is where they need to go. This is where they need to spend their money on is virtualization. And not only is it expandable, it's customizable. So for any of their needs, I mean, whether it's VDI, it depends on what technology they need for their applications and their software.
And T-Bert, I mean, you deal more with the enterprise side. You deal with huge deployments. I know you've been using virtualization. I know that you've been pushing it really hard. Do you see it taking complete control over the enterprise within the next, say, 5-10 years?
There's still a few things that really need a dedicated machine, but they're becoming very, very rare. But one of the things I really ought to point out, especially for the finance people out there, is virtualization, because of the way service level agreements are working and because of the predictive capabilities of a lot of these virtualized systems, is you now have a more predictable cost center. You know, the whole idea of, sorry, boss, I need another $30,000 for another server, while it doesn't go away, it sure starts becoming less and less frequent. Predictable costs is a big deal for finance.
All right, we're running out of time here, so I do want to go give you the last word. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by SAP. These days, much of the conversation about brands, about products, about what is hot and what is not, happens in social media. It's about the blogger who writes a post with his or her experience of a gadget, a gizmo, or something they're wearing. It's about the user putting a Facebook post or a tweet or an entry in Pinterest. It's all about social and how you interact with it. Now, if you are managing social media for a large or medium enterprise, you know how frustrating it can be to stay on top of social media. It's not just the volume of social media, it's all the nuances that you have to capture. You have to know if users are being sarcastic. You have to know if they're being enthusiastic. You have to know if they're being antagonistic or if they really believe in your brand. And then you have to decide how it's going to be handled. Who do you route an email to? Who do you send a tweet to? Who gets to respond to a Facebook post that is either bashing or affirming your brand? That's why we like social media solutions from SAP. Now, social media solutions is divided into two components. The listening component searches the social web in a smart way to know what is being said about your brand. It captures and reports on conversations about relevant terms, passions, patterns, and competitors. It surfaces sentiment and the intensity of it. For example, do your customers like, love, or dislike something? It helps you to build better products by incorporating real-time customer feedback into your innovation efforts. It also helps you identify customers who are ready to buy based on buying signals that they're sending via social media. And it does it by using natural language processing to intelligently and automatically know the difference between nuanced statements such as, the app has never been good, or this app has never been this good. Now, the engaging component is just as important. It's the second aspect of SAP's social media solution service. It helps you improve customer support by allowing you to set the rules about which messages route to whom and how they should be dealt with. For example, if someone tweets a technical support problem, the software can automatically get it to the right person in the technical department and fix their problem in a matter of minutes versus a matter of hours or days. Now, social media solutions from SAP gives you an accurate and real-time understanding of your brand's social media performance. If you manage the social media presence for a large regional or national enterprise, get in touch with SAP. You can find out more by going to sap.com/twit. And we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. About virtualization. So when we are talking about deploying it, either in a small to medium business, small enterprise, large enterprise, what would you say are the top three things that people need to consider or people need to know before they start virtualizing their services?
So you think one of the things is really determine what type of system, what type of application they're going to do. Is it going to be remote desktop? Is it going to be, you know, because if you do remote desktop, you got to think about, well, what if I lose a connection? Do I lose the entire service? Do I need to do a VDI-based type of implementation? So really decide on what's best for your application and your system. And the next thing is, you know, how expandable do I need to be? How administratable do I need to be? Do I need to determine if I need to basically manage everything, or do I just need to manage some things? So those are kind of the top two. The third thing is really how expandable do I want it to be? So there are a lot of things you really have to consider when it comes to this virtualization type things.
T-Bert, what are your warnings to the virtualization noob?
Realistically, you know, write down what you want. You know, you have to know what you need and what you want, and you need to know the difference. Because when you start putting out things like, you know, RFQs for how much is this going to cost, you need to be able to go and determine what can I do without, what do I absolutely need, and be reasonable. Service level agreements can be negotiated till the cows come home. But if you ask for too much, the cloud vendor has no choice but to charge out the yin-yang for it. It's all got a cost. Nothing's for free. But if you have a better idea of what you actually need versus what you want, you're going to have a lot better experience in the long run. So write it down. It's worth taking the time.
Well, that's it. That's all the time we have for this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. The first thing I want to do is I want to invite anyone who is listening to this podcast on a download form to, well, try watching us live. We record every Monday at 12 o'clock Pacific noon. And not only that, if you watch us live, you can jump into the chat room and you'll be able to play with all of the Uber geeks and geniuses that troll that area on a regular basis, including my guest, Lou MM. Furthermore, if you can, why not subscribe to Twiit? Why not go to our page at twit.tv/TWIET and you'll be able to find all the different ways that you can get this podcast, this show, in any form that you want. You want it for iTunes? Great. You want it for Zoom? Sure. You want straight RSS? We've got that too. It's set up by the geniuses here at the Twit Brick House, and we want you to take advantage of it. Also, follow me on Twitter. That's PadreSJ, and you'll be able to find out what we're going to be covering in the next episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. You'll be able to suggest topics for future episodes, or you'll just be able to tell me that I'm doing a horrible job. I love to hear that, too, just because I love to hear from our fans. I want to thank, first of all, Lou. Thank you for coming back. I believe the last time we had you in the Brick House was for the CRM episode, right?
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and of course, you're always welcome back just to even out the anti-Microsoft campaigning that we have on the show. And Brian, any plugs from you? What are you doing? What do you want people to know about? What's going on in the Geek in Paradise?
Actually, I want people to buy my book. I have a book with CRC Press. It's called Cloud Computing: Technologies and Strategies for the Ubiquitous Data Center, and it's from CRC Press. Kurt Franklin and I are actually working on a second book on cloud security and also a third book, thank you, on virtual VDI. So hopefully I'll have my own little bookshelf very soon.
I like that. That was very subtle, Hubert.
Thank you.
I'm all about honesty. So, yeah, thank you very much. And again, thank you to you for stopping by and for watching, because we wouldn't do this if we didn't have people who are interested in the enterprise. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, and I just want to remind you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.